Jarl Mohn, I can't believe I'm seeing you now. It's sort of an out-of-body experience for me. And yet, here we are, two bodies, one on the West Coast, one on the East Coast. And it's just a delight to see you. Thank you for being on Insider Interviews.
Great to see you as well, Amy.
You're kicking off Season 2, Episode 1, with about a year hiatus between seasons. Mm-hmm. So thank you in advance. I can't imagine there's anybody in the media marketing or advertising industry who doesn't know who you are, but I want to start with a little top line. Mm-hmm. And we're going to end up at the toes. So from the head to the toes. Yes, dear listeners, I truly mean the toes. So stay tuned for the payoff of what I'm talking about. But I want to preface this all by saying that you were my first boss in the cable industry. You started entertainment television. That was back in the...
Great time there.
Greg Kinnear and the Howard Stern days. So we'll talk a little bit about that. But what I'd love is for you to maybe share your headlines, a little chronological route to where you are.
Well, I began my career as a disc jockey when I was 15 years old. And I worked at a lot of radio stations. I ended up ultimately in New York at WNBC doing afternoons. That's when I was 25. Then I shifted, got into the programming side of the business. Did that for a number of years at a number of stations, became a general manager. Then I bought some radio stations with some people I used to work with, bought an AM/FM in El Paso, Texas, and then some in Louisville, Kentucky. And then one of the people I knew from the radio business, Bob Pittman, who I had worked with at WNBC, he hired me along with Tom Preston at MTV and VH1. So I got into the cable TV business then. In 1986, I was there for about 4 years and then moved to Los Angeles from New York, and we created E! Entertainment Television. And I was there for 9 years. That's when we had a chance to work together.
Right.
And I did a stint with John Malone at Liberty Media. I was CEO of a company for him called Liberty Digital, which was used to invest in internet companies and some interactive companies. Did that for 4 years. And then I did venture capital, early stage angel investing for myself for about 16. And then I had the opportunity to go back into radio for a very important passion project. I love public radio. I had been involved in public radio in Los Angeles as a board member of KPCC, but I had the opportunity to become CEO of NPR nationally. And I moved to Washington in 2014 to do that for about 6 years. And in October of 2019, I finished up my my tour of duty there and moved back to Los Angeles. That's the career in a nutshell.
Wow. Good bookends. And I know that all of that sort of led to what you're doing now as a philanthropist, which we're going to get into in a little bit. But something that you shared with me, because I always like to ask what my guests would like to talk about. And one of the things that you mentioned was that you definitely did not come from Easy Street. I tend to sing to my guests, so as Annie might sing. So you mentioned that you had been in a group home and foster care, and I'd love to hear how you evolved from that, because you were in good company with actually people like Steve Jobs and Tiffany Haddish, who've been in foster care.
It was really unfortunate. It was a very difficult thing to experience. I spend some time with foster youth and young adults in Los Angeles County now, and have a chance to talk to a number of them. Almost every one of them, using different language, want to know how we survived our PTSD or our trauma. And it was very traumatic for me, but I think a lot of what I did was kind of delusional. I don't know that a mental health professional would recommend my approach, but that's how I fell in love with radio. I hated my existence in that children's home so much. I discovered radio and listened to it nonstop and fantasized about being on the radio and being one of those cool disc jockeys. And that's kind of what my motivation was. So when I got out of the children's home, when I was 15, I had a chance to go to engineering school, get my FCC license, and begin working at a radio station. But it was a number of years there. My two sisters were in the same institution that I was. It was not a happy time. We came from a very permissive home where we could kind of do whatever we wanted to do. And the children's home was highly regimented, almost to the point of being militaristic. That's probably a bit strong, but I don't know that I've ever talked to anybody that had a good time, that enjoyed it.
No. And yet it clearly, out of necessity, gave you some amazing life skills. And I'm not surprised to hear that about radio because, you know, of course, we talk about it as theater of the mind. And yeah. So that escapism and that being able to picture things, that makes a lot of sense. I had an eye-opening experience about that as well, reading a book by a man who actually works at Amazon now, so another media industry person who overcame similar challenges. His name is David Ambrose, and I'm going to add a link to the show notes to his book about living in foster care and how we all need to support youth so much better and try to change things in the world. His book is called A Place Called Home. So, Jarl, I'm glad that you were able to extract some good things out of that experience, and hopefully others will empathize with that and extract more with your words of wisdom.
Well, thank you.
So I promised to go from how you overcame your roots and your evolution to your more current passions, but I want to pay homage to what this podcast is about just for now and stay a little bit more in the present tense of media and marketing and talk about the human touch and NPR. So I'd done a trailer to kick off this episode, promising that we'd get some 2020 hindsight from you in terms of lessons for the future. And we will, but I want to also talk about the value of good content marketing as humanizing executives. And here's another little walk down memory lane. I don't think you need any lessons in humanizing. Jarl, I knew you as Lee Masters, your radio name.
Right.
You
right.
would regularly walk the halls of e-entertainment television, stopping and chatting with every employee every day. And I can't even tell you, those purple metal filing cabinets, I remember them. It was a very cool place.
I thought about those years, yeah.
But that meant the world to everyone. And that was like 25 years ago. But do you know that there's still an employee Facebook group and reunions of past e-employees? So you really created another family for us.
Yeah. Well, thank you. You know, one of the reasons I like walking the hallways there and other places I've worked is it quite often, more often than not, it's a lot more fun than some of the things that I might have been doing in my office. But also, at every company I worked at, found I learned a lot more about what was happening in the company by just walking the halls and asking, what are you working on? What's interesting? What are you getting the biggest kick out of? What are the challenges? And in doing that every day, I don't know that any one conversation led to anything major, but cumulatively, I think there was a lot of information for me and it informed me and really helped me do my job. And it was also a great deal of fun. It made work a lot more playful for me.
Yeah. And we always learn from our coworkers, and too often there's the, you know, it has to be top down. So you made it very horizontal for us and very accessible. So I have a little surprise for you. Testimony. I know. Testimony to the family that you created from back in 1994. One of our coworkers there, Stephanie Morton, just last month, this is really funny, ask if I'd speak with her daughter who's getting into media, Apple, Tree, that kind of thing. Well, your surprise is that her daughter, Grace Morton, is a crackerjack sound editor and engineer. So guess who's going to be editing this episode?
That's great. I love that.
There you go. And then a previous episode I did of Insider Interviews was with our department coordinator, Darren G. Davis. And I don't know if you know what he's up to, but he now runs a very successful comic book company called Tidal Wave. And they're known for their biographical graphic novels, like on Michelle Obama and Dolly Parton. And he just did one on one of your favorites, Dave Grohl. So those were our roots.
That's fabulous.
Yep. But back to you. I want to talk about at NPR how you kind of continued that walk the hall approach, but you did it from the skies and the road. Tell us about visiting NPR stations.
Well, as I mentioned before, I tried to do that everywhere, and I found that NPR walking the hallways was one way of doing it. But when I began at NPR, one of my good friends, Michael Govan, who is director of LA County Museum of Art, also a pilot, and he has a single engine Bonanza that he flies. He said, why don't we fly from the West Coast to the East Coast and visit small NPR stations that no one from NPR has ever been to? And I said, wow, what a great idea. I'm often credited with this idea. It was actually Michael's. We probably hit 15, 17 stations in that 10-day period of time and made a lot of friends and got to meet the people that work at these stations and got to meet donors and listeners and have some great local food. And that was in 2014 when I started. 2016, I had never driven across the country, and that's kind of a rite of passage for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And so I drove from Washington, D.C. to Los Angeles, and I allowed myself 3 weeks, and I drove through the South. And I did the same thing, visiting probably 20 or more radio stations. So we had a chance to be out in the field and meet with people and meet the stations, meet the staffs, program directors, news directors, got to meet listeners, donors. And it was a great educational experience for me, in addition to being really fun.
Yes. And so you listened to a lot of radio, I'm sure, while you were driving across country.
Yep.
So let's talk about that. I know you as very socially responsible, and I know you just traded in the old minivan.
I have a Tesla, but the new minivan is a hybrid. So,
okay, good. All right, then. But a lot of the news is that those electric vehicle industry folks are saying that there's interference with electric cars. And so we might be facing the demise of AM radio. So let's go down that route, so to speak.
Sure. Well, I think there are a couple of issues. When I made the transition to FM radio in 1974, I had been on AM radio. I took a job at an FM rock station in Miami because FM was really coming on, particularly for music stations. And if you had asked me then in 1974, what I thought the prognosis was, let's call it 48 years ago, almost 50 years ago, I would have said everybody had completely written off AM radio at that time. But since then, up until even recently, there are a number of markets like Atlanta, let's say, where you have the number one radio station in the market is WSB, an AM radio station. And there are a handful of others. And the reason they can be successful is they're offering something that's not available anywhere else. Whether it's the Atlanta Braves or whether it is, you know, a morning personality. But I would have never thought 48 years later that any AM station would still exist, let alone being number one in their market. I do think the radio business itself is very, very challenged. AM certainly has been for a long time, you know. Very few make a lot of money. But FM and radio in general is also under siege. A lot of it, I think, is self-inflicted wounds, from having commercial loads that are too high to being very repetitive and so forth. A lot of people have written off all of radio, not just AM. I do believe, and one of the reasons I love NPR and public radio, is I really think that it's providing something that you can't get anywhere else. Even if you're in a major market city, you can be listening to, you know, a traditional news station that gives you traffic and weather on the ones, let's say. But in terms of news analysis, stories, you know, really audio essays on what's going on and explaining, not just saying, here are the facts, here's what's happened, but providing background, some context and so forth, and storytelling, I think is something that's not available anywhere else. I just don't think there's anything like it. I do think a lot of the music formats are under siege from Spotify and from satellite radio, but I'm still very, very bullish for public radio. Now, the problem is if a lot of people are deserting the broadcast band because of music, your pool of available listeners for an NPR station starts to decline. But I think they're going to hang in a lot longer than anybody else.
Yes. And our friend Pierre Bouvard, who is the head of research over at Cumulus Westwood One, is fond of pointing out that there's a big difference in perception and reality. So I think it's 86% of U.S. adults still listen to radio regularly. And surprisingly, the biggest demo is 18 to 34. So hopefully it's not going anywhere. And I know that you've done your part to make sure that NPR is not going anywhere either. You, for your recent birthday, bequeathed every single one of the 251 stations with membership in them, and you got a mug from each one. So
I've got a great collection of NPR mugs. It's really funny.
You're Instagram famous for that now.
It's a lot of fun. And, you know, whenever we have people over, of all the things that we show them in the house, the thing that is the most interesting and fun for them is the shelving of the NPR mugs. People get a big kick out of it.
Well, you know, I know that you are a big art collector, so the fact that the NPR mugs are one of the big draws is quite a statement. Let's stay with media for just a second longer, because we've talked a lot about audio. I want to talk about where you would really advise media companies and how they need to pivot. I don't even know what the acronyms anymore are, MVPD and CTV and all of that. But what tech do you think is going to have the most significant impact now on the future of media? I mean, between metaverse and AI and maybe in your case, DALL-E, synthetic voice, discuss.
You know, I don't know what the impact of those technologies are going to be on traditional media. I'm a big consumer of traditional media, meaning motion pictures, television programming. I don't watch much broadcast television anymore. I don't watch any linear television, maybe one or two shows a week. The rest are things I watch in streaming. And of course, anybody that's listening or watching this now understands what's happening in the streaming world, where these incredible budgets of $12 billion a year or $6, $7 billion a year per company, the economics right now don't look like they're working. However, a lot of people seem to enjoy using them. And, you know, one of the number one topics of conversations at almost every dinner party is, what are you watching? And everybody is exchanging their lists of, you know, what am I seeing on Netflix? Did you see Kaleidoscope on Netflix? Have you seen The Chestnut Man on Netflix? Have you watched Echo 3 on Apple TV? Or have you watched Slow Horses? And I think a lot of people are looking at content. The challenge, of course, is how many of these services can you subscribe to? You know, people aren't going to subscribe to all of them. So that's going to be a challenge. The investment has been huge. How do you make people aware of what's available? But I always believe, regardless of what the medium is, whether it's an audio or a visual, whether it's broadcast radio, whether it's a podcast, whether it's broadcast television, whether it's a cable network, whether it's streaming, whether it's on demand, I think when everything is said and done, really good content wins. Good content has to be differentiated, particularly in the television business. It's very expensive to do. That's why only a few people can do it. But I really don't think too much or worry too much about the technology. You know, my job is not at risk from that. A lot of people have to be worried about that a lot. Which way do we turn? But whatever your format is, whatever your technological platform is, the quality and the differentiation and the uniqueness of what you're producing is hugely important. So really focus on the quality of what you're producing to make it as interesting and mouthwatering as possible. And I would also add and put an addendum on that, you know, because I'm not in the trenches every day dealing with this inside a media company like I was when I was at NPR. I'm not studying it as closely, and I view it as someone that is kind of close, but not in the center of it anymore.
Well, let's go a little bit closer to home through two forks here. The first is that you mentioned, of course, good content and the water cooler aspect of things. You know, are you watching Slow Horses? I know it's one of your favorite shows, but I am always challenged by someone will suggest something and I have no idea where to find it. So that leads to the marketing aspect of it and creating awareness and aligning with which of these services. So I think that in and of itself is a big challenge. And I'm going out on a limb and saying that I'm not a fan of the EPG, the directory for Apple TV. I don't know what to look for there. I love their content, but I don't know how to find the content on it.
I think it's difficult for any of the services to find what you're looking for. I'm troubled by all of them. I find it really messy. But in terms of recommendations, the great news is if somebody says Slow Horses, which is an Apple TV Plus, but you don't know where it is, you know, you can pop it into, you know, Dr. Google, and you're going to find out pretty quickly where it is. And if something is available on a number of platforms, you can pick the one that you're a subscriber to. But discovering something new on your own, I think is difficult. And one of the things maddening to me, and I think it looks to me like they've tried to solve it, but not particularly well, and I haven't figured it out, is, you know, when I turn on, let's say, Apple TV, that has all the tiles of the various services, you would think that it would be very easy to start finding what you had been watching already. And I think the intention of these services is to make it easy for you to jump back into, for instance, I was watching The Chestnut Man on Netflix. But it isn't always. I go to Netflix and I would expect that would be the first thing that would pop up. And for some reason, it doesn't. They don't make it as easy for us as you would think.
That's a great point, especially because my drug of choice is the Amazon Fire Stick. And so it's promoting what I last watched via Prime Video. Mm-hmm. And so I don't necessarily get served up Chestnut Man that I had been watching elsewhere. Good point. You know, I did a couple of interviews with NPR's CMO, Michael Smith, who's been working hard to up the diversity and representation across NPR's content and its constituents. And that brings me to another question that brings us closer to what you're doing now and social responsibility and things like that. Do you think that the media industry has made strides in the past few years in terms of improved DEI, and what do you think are the number one or two action steps that any media company or service can really do to help legitimize its brand purpose or good DEI?
Mm-hmm. I'm certainly not an expert on this. I think it's a hugely important topic for everybody, not just media companies. It's an issue for museums. Museums are questioning this historical perspective on white European males in their collection. And why have women been ignored? Why have people of color been ignored for so long? It's a huge issue in the art world. The museums aren't making as much progress as the art world is, and the galleries are, and some of the new contemporary museums that are doing a much better job of doing exhibitions from women and people of color. Again, I'm not an expert on this, but I think there's been progress. I think one of the big challenges for every organization has been a limited number of people with background or expertise in any particular field, whether it's broadcast or whether it's the museum world. And there's a huge amount of demand for people of color in some of these roles. And so what I've seen, my personal experience at NPR, was bringing people in who were terrific, had a great sensibility, incredible intelligence, very talented, doing great work. And NPR is a not-for-profit. And very quickly, somebody comes in and snags them, whether it's the New York Times or MSNBC. And this happened to us constantly. We'd find somebody we thought was really terrific. We'd bring them in. We'd train them in our ways and kind of our sound. And in 18 months or 2 years, they were off to a much bigger paycheck, which is great. I mean, great for them. But then the job is not adding one more person or two or three or five, you know, five more people to the organization. You got to go back to square one to fill this position again. So you're almost always going back to the beginning. So that was one of our challenges. But I do think most organizations, certainly in the arts, and I think many, many organizations are really trying, and some of them are doing better than others, but I don't think it's an easy task.
Hey, well, onward, I guess. You teed me up pretty well to talk about your life's purpose these days, aside from mountain biking and crossword puzzles. You're still making headlines, but now it's really more in the art world. And I'm so floored by how your philanthropy has evolved. And I'd love for you to talk about the land grant and what you and your wife, Pamela, have bequeathed to LA artists.
Mm. Well, thank you. It started kind of organically. We've had the Family Foundation for 25 years, say, and it's been a learning experience from, you know, writing many, many, many small and moderate sized checks to then figuring out, well, we really want to have impact. So we really should probably write fewer checks, but write bigger checks and really get behind projects and trying to figure out what we really believe in. So we really feel we can do a lot more good if we focus on one area. We live in the largest county in the United States, which is LA County. So there's a lot going on here. There are a lot of issues and problems here, but there are also some beautiful things and some beautiful opportunities. So we're focused on a handful of things primarily. I'd say 85% of what we do is LA County, and it's around social justice. So of course the ACLU, Southern California is a big one. I was chair there for 13 years. So we really believe in civil liberties and the rights of people that really don't have the kind of representation that they should. Foster youth, because of my background, we're really in the early stages of figuring out how we're going to work with that. We're focusing even more on what are called transition age youth, which is 18 to 24, because a lot of the system kind of ends for them when they get out of high school. And so we think there's an opportunity there for 18 to 24-year-olds in LA County. The arts is really important to me. And again, we've narrowed the focus to emerging artists who live and work in Los Angeles County. So the land grants, the Moan land grants you talked about, is something we just announced with LA Nomadic Division, which does public art. We're going to do grants for 20 emerging artists that live and work in LA over the next 5 years. They have to not have any major institution or gallery representation. And we just announced the first recipients, and they're going to do public art. They're each going to create works that will be in their neighborhoods, publicly available, not in a museum, not in a gallery, that will speak to the people and the issues of that community. We also have been involved we're in year 11 of the Hammer Museum's Made in LA exhibition. We're a major underwriter for that. We have a number of awards, the Moan Award. We have three of them that we give away to LA emerging artists or under-recognized LA artists. And we've also been involved with another public not-for-profit space called LAX Art. And the other one, of course, is public radio. Locally here in Los Angeles with KPCC, where I've been affiliated for many, many, many years. But we also support KCRW, the other NPR station, and deeply engaged with NPR nationally. And then the other 15%, we sprinkle into kind of ad hoc things that pop up.
Phenomenal. So the art of content, the art of art, great ways to give back.
I find art really inspiring, and I encourage anybody, regardless of how they feel about art, try to spend some time with it, because it really does open up different neural pathways. I always have found if I'm stuck creatively on something, that if I go to a museum and I look at art, I don't look at a piece of art and go, oh, that makes me think of this. It just, it frees up my mind. I think art is beautiful that way. And I'm not just talking about the visual arts. I'm talking about film. I'm talking about music. I'm talking about dance. There are beautiful things happening in culture everywhere. And this is going to sound odd, but I've said it quite often. If I'm really stuck, I like to go look at art that I don't like. I like to look at art that I don't understand. I like to look at art that the critics have said great things about, but for whatever reason, doesn't appeal to me. Because what is it that the people that are far better educated than I am on this subject see in it that I don't see in it? And there really must be something there. I find it opens up my mind. If not at that moment, it does later. So my pro tip for anybody that is in anything creative or has to do problem solving, go to museums regularly and look at stuff and go out of your way to look at things that you might not like. It takes a little patience, but for me, it's been deeply rewarding.
Well, I think that you also just answered one of the rationales for why we need more inclusion and more voices in media, if I can bring it full circle for a minute, because looking at something that you're not used to or that doesn't necessarily resonate with you could illuminate new ideas for you. And it amplifies fresh voices. I promised that we would bring it from the head to the toes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, now that you're retired and you're purging some old things, you bequeathed some art to your friends in social media and anyone who requested this incredible piece of art from you would receive them at no charge with a handwritten note, which you like to do to personalize things. So everybody, I would like to share the Jarl Mohn faces on socks. Oh, I showed you the dirty side, but you can see they're well worn and well loved. And for those who are just listening to the audio version of this, as a good podcast should be, these are socks that had Jarl's face when he was more of a Lee Masters groovy DJ. And his more recent executive face when he was at NPR, and they were premiums on socks, which happened to be very well made, by the way. A nice gauge. The toes are seamless. I wear them all the time. So I have your face on my feet all the time, Jarl. Thank you.
The story behind those is quite funny. I don't want anybody to think I actually had socks made with my face on them. I got a text one morning from the president of KCRW, which is, you know, one of the NPR stations here in LA. She was at the NPR headquarters waiting for a board meeting and working at one of the temporary desks. And there was a big box on the desk. And she was just curious. She opened it up and all these socks were in there with my picture on it. And she texted me a photograph of these. And she said, "What are these?" And I said, "Jennifer, I have absolutely no idea. You've got to be kidding me. This is hilarious. Why would there be socks with my face on them at NPR? I'd been gone 2.5 years at that point. What in the world?" And so I said, "Can you find out? You're there. Why don't you ask?" She asked around. About an hour later, she sent me a note and she said they had been left over from when I was leaving NPR. They were going to have this joke, which is for my going away party. Everybody was going to these socks, and they had ordered them. And what happened was they didn't arrive until after I had left. So they were just sitting there. And so I said, "Well, ask them if they need them. I can't imagine anybody has any need for these things. You know, instead of throwing them out, can you ship them to me?" And they were shipped to me. And then I put it up on Instagram and Facebook. And I told anybody, "If you want a pair, let me know and I'll shoot them to you." So they went very quickly. I was really surprised, like, who in the world is going to want these? But it's just goofy enough that people love it. So
And that turned into Stocktober, and it was like, Where's Waldo and Elf on a Shelf meme for a while. Yes, it made me very happy. So I want to end with a quote from an NPR story that was on All Things Considered last month about happiness. Mm-hmm. And I think that they were singing off of your song sheet, Jarl. The story said that if people could change one thing in their lives to be happier, what does the data say they should choose? They should invest in their relationships with other people.
Yep.
So with that, Jarl, I'd like to say that you've made me very happy for joining me and for being such a bar-raising human in my life who's made so many people happy. And I want to really thank you for sharing with all of us today.
Well, it's made me happy being here with you, Evie. Thank you.
Please make sure that you check the show notes out. There's information about foster care, about Jarl's investments in art, about land and LA artists. And I would love for you to support your NPR stations. That's a really good idea. Well, I hope you got some good insider scoop from this episode of Insider Interviews with me, E.B. Moss. If you enjoyed this content, please feel free to buy me a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/mossappeal. And I hope you'll follow Insider Interviews on social media and let me know if you have a question or a suggestion for a next stellar guest in media, marketing, and advertising. Speaking of stellar, my theme music was composed and performed by the incomparable Grammy-winning John Clayton. If I can help you with your company's podcast, please find me at mossappeal.com. Thanks again for listening.